Hey, listeners. I'm Karen Riley Jeffers, NCSM's Eastern 2 Director. Welcome to our series, Learning with Leaders, Everyone Belongs in Mathematics. Thank you for joining me and my co-host, Abel Maestas, the host of Teaching That Counts, as we talk with both leaders and influencers about their math journeys and contributions. Today, we will hear from our special guests about their inspiration, perceptions, and insights regarding instructional decisions that make the mathematics space welcoming and engaging to all. Listen and learn about how beliefs, practices, and policies must continue to advance to ensure that each and every person feels a sense of belonging in mathematics.
All right, well, welcome this month to our NCSM podcast, Learning with Leaders. And we'd like to welcome with us this, I should probably introduce myself. I'm Abel Maestas. And as always, right, it's been since November. I figure everyone listening to us just knows who we are, huh? And co-host and our awesome other co-host is?
Karen Riley Jeffers.
And we're welcome everybody to our podcast, to the NCSM Learning with Leaders podcast. This month is so awesome. We get to welcome the wonderful Lynn Godfrey. So Lynn, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you. I'm glad to be here.
Thank you. So everyone, just a little bit about Lynn. Liz is an educational math consultant who works with schools and districts to design and facilitate professional learning with coaches, teachers, and administrators to grow ambitious, equitable learning communities in their schools. As an educator, Lynn served as a classroom teacher in grades 2 through 8 in Cambridge and Boston, district math coach for Cambridge Public Schools, upper school coordinator and math coach at Young Achievers Science and Math Pilot School, and the director of instruction, curriculum, and adult development for mathematics at the Dudley Street Neighborhood Charter School and Boston Teacher Residency. It is in her work with Bob Moses and the Algebra Project for over 30 years, both locally and nationally, that has influenced and sustains her ongoing commitment to access and equity for all adults and all children in mathematics, where ambitious teaching and learning are a civil right. So there's a little bit about Lynn. Lynn, thank you again for being with us today.
I'm also excited because it's rare that I get to meet someone who is from Boston, because that is my home where I grew up. And so it's wonderful to hear that such great work is taking place in my home state. So before we begin, I know Abel just introduced you, but if you'll share some of your journey in education that has led you to your current work.
And as you both know, it's been a long journey, and we can talk more about that later. But I think probably just the fact that I am a Black woman. And so coming through math classes and my experience, my own personal experiences in math, both as a student and as a teacher, have really informed my journey. But even more so as a parent of 3 daughters and a grandparent, 2 grandsons, it has also informed my journey as well. So I started out teaching at the King Open School, as you said, Abel, as a 5th and 6th grade teacher. And fortunately, I had all of Bob and Janet Moses' children as students in my classroom. And so the benefit of that was meant that I also had Bob Moses in my classroom. And that work at the King Open with the Algebra Project and the transition curriculum just led me to certain experiences with the Algebra Project, both locally and nationally. Karen, what you were saying about, you know, being from Massachusetts, that's one context, right? But having the experience of working in other states with other teachers and students really opened my eyes to what math education looked like across the country, and really deepening my understanding of what Bob meant by MAC as a civil right, not just, you know, for me personally, but what it meant for, what it means, it still means for our nation.
Thank you.
Yeah, thank you. Mm-hmm. So in all of your work with different areas, different states, and different teachers, different students around our country, you've had an opportunity to see students belonging, teachers belonging, and our season series is titled Everyone Belongs in Math. So our leading question is for all our guests is, what does it mean to belong in mathematics?
So a big question. And I think, you know, depending on who you ask, you'll get different responses. But for me, belonging in math means, even though the person who's organizing or facilitating the class might not look like me, they see me and they hear me. It means that the students in that room know that they bring something with them. They show up at the door, they bring something into the classroom. They're the contributors to the classroom, that their thinking is valued and taken up, right, as the content in the classroom. So it's not a, there's just one group of people who do this, but we all belong in this because we all think, we all have ideas worth sharing, and working with, you know, the adults to actually know how to use what kids are giving to them to move the math forward.
I love that. I'm really interested in hearing. I think it's rare and it's special that we have a guest that can give a personal account of work with Bob Moses. We hear a lot about him, we read about him, and you're the first person that I've personally met that has rubbed shoulders with him that could share about his work. So could you, for those who don't know what the Algebra Project is, just share a bit about the project and how it promotes belonging in math?
There are lots of folks that Bob worked with. And I always say that, you know, I was in the right place at the right time, but I will be honest with you and tell you there were days when I thought, oh, I'm exhausted. You're kidding. And Bob's energy, not like, explosive energy, but his calm, steady energy to stay with this work, is something that I learned from him. And that, you know, people talk about there's this urgency to do this work. But I never felt that the urgency meant that we had to hurry. And so when Bob's oldest daughter, Maisha, was in my classroom, when I came into teaching, I was teaching math in the way I had been taught math. Which meant my colleague and I took all of our fifth and sixth graders, gave them a test, and placed them in what in groups according to how they performed on that test. And so when Bob, he had first started work, he followed Maisha into seventh and eighth grade and worked with her then. But he was developing these materials and he came to me and he said, so what do you think about trying these materials out in your classroom? And what do you think about trying to teach math in the way you teach social studies or literature, where it's not, they're not placed in these groups, but it's really for everybody? And I didn't know what that meant. I didn't know what it would look like. And so when Bob and I first started working together, he was really clear, like this, the material was going to be developed in the classroom with students and with teachers. He didn't come with something already prepared, already bound in a textbook. And so that was pretty scary because I was used to the textbook that had, you know, the answers to the problems at the back of the book and had the procedures that kids were to learn. So the process, though, that Bob brought to this was the five-step curricula process. And what that meant was really thinking about how do we start with some event or experience that all students have some have experienced. And so that meant that there wasn't a group of students that had, that knew something about equivalence. We thought of contexts in which students had experiences, lived experiences, where we could build their understanding of equivalence and use that to mathematize that experience. So the five-step process started with this physical event. Our first event was taking a ride on the T. At that time, the kids knew more about riding the T than I did because, you know, I got in my car every morning. I drove to work. I drove back. But they knew how to ride the T, the direction it was going, inbound or outbound, the names of the stations, all of that. I had all of the sixth graders together. So from that physical event, they moved to the next step, which was for them to draw pictures or make a model of that experience. And I was talking to somebody the other day about the power of a picture, the power of a visual to represent what I've experienced, and how, you know, that was such a powerful move in the classroom. And then this third step, which to me was really the exception, was using kids' own language to describe what they experienced. So it wasn't that you knew the mathematical vocabulary or the academic vocabulary. You used the language, your own intuitive language, to describe what you experienced. And from that intuitive language, that was, to me, was the real bridge between that and what we would normally see in the textbook, which I call the structured language. So what are the features of that experience that end up getting mathematized? And from there, moving to the symbolic representation. When we started out and students were told, this really is for you to create, and they looked at the little booklets that we had put together, there was a lot of empty space for kids to draw pictures, make models, write about their experiences in their own language, and then move towards the symbolic representation. And to me, that just that curricular process itself created a space where everybody belonged. Everybody could contribute. There wasn't, you know, one group of students who were efficient with an algorithm that they were taught, but every single student could bring something to that and contribute their own thinking to it. One other piece that was really important in the algebra project classroom that was very different from how we were doing math were the three kinds of work that we did in math. So prior to working with Bob in the algebra project, you know, we had the kids in different groups. I had what was considered the high group, and they worked out of the Saxon one-half book pretty much on their own. And I worked with the other group, which were the lower performing group. And I was telling them mostly what I thought they needed to know. Well, the kinds of work changed dramatically in the math classroom. Students had time to do individual work, you know, get their individual thinking time in there. And they worked in small groups or in teams. We called them teams, and they took real ownership of naming their team, working cooperatively as a team. And then that whole class community work where the teams brought their ideas to the table, and the whole community either The work was really about understanding what each team was bringing to the table and, if possible, working toward consensus. And anybody who's ever worked toward consensus knows that's a really long and sometimes challenging process. But that's what Bob meant when he said, what if you taught math the way you teach social studies? And so it was really modeled more on that way of teaching.
I heard so much in the little bit that you shared that made me think of Lisa Delpit, Other People's Children.
Mm-hmm.
It also made me think of Teaching for Social Justice. You mentioned the T for our listeners who have no idea what the T is. It's a Boston girl. It warms
me. Or co-host. I don't know about
T. My father used
I'm
to
guessing work. It's like Bart here in
Central. Yeah, my father used to work for the T. He built the engines for the buses. So the T, for those who do not know, that's the public transportation system that runs in and outside of Boston. Spent a lot of time on the T.
Mm-hmm. And what's so cool about the transition curriculum and that whole thing of using the T to establish this, you know, eventually, you know, becomes an integer model. But almost every city we went into, right, had a public transportation system. And when they didn't, we did school bus trips and we stopped at different, you know, historical locations. So again, starting with that physical experience that everybody can have really changed.
Yeah, because in major cities, once you get past a certain grade level, it's public transportation. So,
right.
Yep.
Yeah. Wow. Yeah, we have public transport where I live. We have public transportation, but it's not like the big what a lot of people use. In California, you know, you probably hear the stories that a lot of people don't use public transportation.
Right.
That's not true in the bigger cities. There's a lot of public transportation being used, but like LA and San Francisco. So, I'm glad you said that about the buses, school buses too. School buses were used a lot in our area. Yeah. I love this idea of, that you said about consensus making and working towards consensus. I know that is a key element to something that my kids have been working on in their classes is working towards consensus. And I really do think when you do work towards consensus and you have a team, it reminds me of Jaime Escalante and the team building in his classroom in that culture and making all students belong and feel like they belong to something. In your other work too, you've been a huge advocate of equity and equity in mathematics through I saw you were in a ton of leadership organizations that you're a part of, and you work with leaders, and that's what we here at NCSM are all about, leaders, coaches, and people that are working with teachers all the time. How can the work with leaders specifically help create spaces for belonging with kids?
Ooh, the work with leaders. I have worked in different contexts with different teacher or educational leaders. One that comes to mind that was more recent is the work with Boston Teacher Residency. And so in that work, so people, you know, sign up or they come to Boston Teacher Residency to learn teaching and to learn learning. Mm. And the folks who teach the courses are practitioners, not necessarily university folk, but people who are in it and who have done the work. And so, one of the goals, right, is to work with novice teachers to learn how to know their students. And So a lot of the work that I did with others, Magdalene Lampert was one of the people who worked with us in forming a group of clinical teacher educators who really looked at, so how do we work with the teachers that were, you know, the novice teachers and the cooperating teachers to really learn how to create this community inside their classrooms for their students. And to me, that, you know, that work wasn't simple. And it meant that the group of adults had to like kind of put ego and status behind them. And we spent a lot of time bringing our work to the table to learn with and from each other, because we knew that there was more that we could learn if we were willing to make our practice public with each other. We did. And so in terms of like developing those skills as leaders, we did a lot of visiting with each other so that we could see what it looked like in different contexts. We did a lot of work with learning coaching. Coaching is kind of like teaching. It's not just coming in to tell, but really facilitating and fostering the best that you can get from everybody in the room. We worked a lot with Lucy West and Tony Cameron on content-focused coaching so that people were not... so that you didn't have a person who was a first grade teacher or a first grade clinical teacher educator working with the 10th grade math teacher. But you really needed to know your content deeply. You needed to know the content needed for teaching deeply, and you needed to know students. So that work, carried outside of BTR, Boston Teacher Residency, and continued in the work that I did with the math coaches both in Cambridge and work that I did in the schools in Boston. As you know, so if you want to, if this is about children, students, and us learning what we need to do for them, then we've got to like do some work ourselves.
You have me thinking about my own just history of education growing up in Boston, and thinking about some of my experiences, great and not so great. And, you know, truth be told, I had some teachers that would have greatly benefited from being a part of something like this that supported them in knowing their content deeply and their pedagogy deeply and their students as well.
And, you know, I know oftentimes when people ask me, so what do you teach teachers in the teacher preparation program? And so, yes, a lot of it is teaching the math, right? But so much of it is teaching how to listen and how to listen without, you know, kind of positioning yourself to correct or tell, but really listening for understanding. And I think, you know, that may sound like, oh, okay, that's nice, but what does that really mean? Mm-hmm. And what does that really do for kids? Mm-hmm. And when you see what it does for kids, that's when I feel like we've made real progress. And that's where you start seeing change also.
In all of these experiences, just thinking about what you shared about the algebra project and what you just shared, making a connection back to last month's podcast where Dr. Matthews asked the question, like, is math a space where I want to belong? And just through listening to you, I feel like you created spaces that supported students and teachers in feeling that math was a place for them to belong in. Just helping to bring math to life and making it real and connecting it to their lived experiences. So like in all of these experiences throughout your career, has there been one that really spoke to you in bringing belonging to the forefront?
That's a hard question, Karen, because there have been so many experiences where belonging has played such a pivotal role in my learning and in others' learning. And I'll talk about a couple of incidents, right? So one is from my own experience as a parent of a daughter who, when she was in seventh grade, they started tracking in her math classes. And she said to me, I should be in the advanced class. And the school, the director of math said, no, it's better if she stays where she is. We don't want to upset her, you know, confidence. I thought, this is my daughter telling me she believes she belongs. So I brought that to Bob and my algebra project family. And Bob's response was, well, you should ask the director to give you the curriculum that they use in the advanced program, and you'll do it with her. And I did. I said that. And he said, well, okay, all right, we'll take a chance. If you want to do that, we're going to put her in the class. And she did go into the class. And she said after the first test, when she got a D, she thought, oh, what have I done? But it was a teacher she had, the teacher of that class, who made it clear to her, you know what? It just means we have to work differently. There's something else, something that we're not doing. We'll figure this out. And they did figure it out. And, you know, it's the Cinderella story. She got the A. She's a math teacher. She loves math. Her kids love math. Her students love math. And that belief, that trust in our children speaks volumes, but also teachers who believe that, this Black girl belongs in this classroom. It's something I need to figure out. It's such a different stance than what I heard from so many teachers, which is they're not ready. They can't do this. We don't want to upset their confidence. So just having that experience myself, I map that on to any space that I go into, any room that I walk into. And if a teacher says to me, you know, these kids, this group really can't, you know, they can't handle this, or they're not able to do this, it's my job. I feel it's my job, and it's, you know, anybody who's working with folks to learn this, to help them to see those students and to see what it is they can do. One other example that I want to share is I was recently in a third grade classroom, and the students were working on bar graphs. They were creating bar graphs. They were analyzing the graphs. And the teacher said, okay, I'm going to call on folks to come up, and you're going to draw the, you know, graph or the data that you collected on the bar graph. And so a couple of students had come up, and then she called on this one student to come up, and he was excited to go up, but he got to the board and he drew what he thought was representative of the data he collected. And another student said, no, that's not it. And so the teacher did this move. She said, well, you know what? Sometimes we just got to step back from it and take another look. And so the student stepped back, and he could see that the bar that he'd drawn meet up to the number that he wanted it to represent. And he was able to make that correction himself. So when we were in the debrief after the class, and the teacher was saying, you know, I know I'm not really great at math, and you know, I don't know what I'm doing. And I said, what do you mean? What you said to that student is what mathematicians do. You step back and you take a look, you give yourself time to pause and actually look at and analyze what it is that you've done. And she just was so happy. She said, nobody has ever told her that she's ever done anything that's mathematical that would promote students' identity in math and or as mathematicians. And so when I think about this work, I think about the teachers and the students, and everybody needs this sense of belonging, and they need evidence that they are doing certain things that are creating the space for the students and for themselves to do this kind of learning.
I really like that. I wrote down the power of stepping away and reflecting. And then I got this visual of like the scene in Hidden Figures where they're like writing on the board and, you know, they have to step away and come back and then things change. But, you know, that's what mathematicians do.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah, totally what mathematicians do. And it just got me thinking, you know, how many elementary teachers and secondary teachers, definitely in my in some experience recently, secondary teachers feel like they don't belong in the math space. Like they are afraid of the mathematics, and sometimes it's bringing them into it and making them feel like they belong. I love the idea of just giving them that evidence and that, yeah, that is what mathematicians do. You did exactly what a math, and not only did you do that, but you taught a student how to do that. Mm-hmm. And I thought that was pretty powerful. So as we round out, it was just a wonderful conversation today, and I really appreciate all the vast experience that you've had with all of the work that you've done in equity and belonging and sharing all of that experience with us today. We ask all of our guests to give one tip that leaders can do right now to support a sense of belonging in mathematics.
Let's see. My one tip comes from my experiences, which is to keep learning. So there, I can't tell you how many educators I've continued to learn from, people like Robert Berry, the book about Black children and math, brilliance of Black children in mathematics. I didn't know a lot about working with neurodiverse students or multilingual students, and some of the folks that I've continued to learn with and from, like Rachel Lambert and others, just like that would be my tip. Keep learning and to not give up, as the evidence actually speaks volumes to teachers and to students. So keep going. Yeah.
Yeah. Thank you for that. It reminds me of, and I don't know if I've ever mentioned this on this podcast, but and this is not in any way a advertisement for this, but I watched the show Abbott Elementary. I'm not sure if you've seen Abbott Elementary. I love that show. I feel like it's one of the truest depictions of teaching that I've seen portrayed on television. But there's this one scene, and I show it to my teachers now. I like log in and show them this one scene. And this one scene is the newer teacher has been doing this lesson with these kids for a few years, and the students have always done well on this test. Well, this year they didn't do well on the test. And she started looking for things, the reasons why they didn't do well on the test. Was it because they didn't get enough sleep? Was it because they didn't eat well? Was it all these other things? And she walks into the staff room, and the more experienced teachers were kind of chuckling at her, and they finally said, well, then now you know it's not the stuff, it's you. And she was like shocked, and she says, do you ever, isn't there just a time when you just, like, things start cruising along and you just know what to do? And they were like, no, it's when you don't know what to do and that you have to switch things up that you know you're in the groove. Like, as teachers and leaders, being in the groove is knowing when to change things that we need to, and we need to learn about new stuff. I did not know a lot about UDL, and I've started to learn more and more about that recently, and working with neurodiverse students. So I think it's really, really important, your tip, to keep learning.
Well, if we stop doing that, you know what they say, so.
Yep, this has been great. This has been awesome. Thank you so much for joining us today. As I shared earlier before we started, I learned so much through these podcasts. And thank you for taking us down a walk through your historical journey and your work. You've done some amazing things. And one of the things that I'm taking away is just and connecting back to another podcast with Running Horse Livingston, where he said there's really nothing new under the sun. And a lot of things that we're doing now and that we're uplifting are things that have been done for a long time. They just may not have been like promoted and advertised and in the way that we're doing now. And there wasn't anything new that was shared. It was just nice to know that this is something that was existing for a long period of time. And we're just now catching on to the traction, you know, and to be able to be at one of the forefronts of such major work that there's still some that we're hoping to bring along on the train as we continue on this journey. So thank you so much for being here, for spending this time with us, and for sharing your light. Is there any way for our listeners to learn a little bit more about you and your works?
More recent work is on the Forum for Equity in Elementary Mathematics website. And there are lots of resources, there are blogs, there are sessions that some of the folks that I mentioned have done sessions with us. And, you know, I always think if you want to learn more about the Algebra Project's work, you can go to algebra.org or read Radical Equations, which was written by Charlie Cobb and Bob Moses. And I personally am on sometimes on LinkedIn, but I don't do a lot of social media. Those two sites, I think there's a lot that folks can learn about. And this is really great project that Bill Crombie is working on with the Algebra Project. It's called the Accessible Calculus Project. It's what I wish I'd had when I was taking calculus. So those are a few places, I think, where people can learn more about work.
Thank you.
Thank you. I'm going to check that out.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, thank you so much again, Lynn, for joining us today. We really appreciate all of your knowledge and your time.
Well, thank you both. I enjoyed talking with you.
Thank you, everybody, for joining us. And we'll see and hear everyone next time.
We hope that you have been inspired by this bold mathematics leadership conversation, and we'll tune into our podcast series each month. If you enjoyed this episode, please share it with others, post about it on social media, or leave a rating and review. You can learn more about NCSM Leadership and Mathematics Education and our upcoming professional learning events on the NCSM website, mathedleadership.com. You can also follow NCSM on the X at MathEdLeaders and using the hashtag NCSMBold. Until next time.